Hello, everybody. It's been a very nice week so far. So my name's Paul. I'm a professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Toronto. I'm a visitor here. Over my sabbatical, in addition to hanging out here for several weeks, I'm also spending some time working with a philanthropic organization, the Paul Allen Philanthropies in Seattle. So we're looking at next generation climate modeling and how that could be supported from philanthropic investments. But today I'll be talking about my core research area of atmosphere, cryosphere science focused on snow and sea ice. As a modeler, I have to be totally honest to start with. This is the closest I've been to the Arctic. This is flying over in a jet plane, the Mackenzie Delta, a few months ago. I'm the PI of a Canadian research network called the Canadian Sea Ice and Snow Evolution Network, CANSICE. It's just finishing up a 5 years of operation. We were focused on basically data mining, looking at existing observational data sets gathered by my hardworking colleagues in Environment and Climate Change Canada, trying to understand how current generation climate models, the Canadian model included, represent snow and sea ice processes and focusing on seasonal and longer timescale forecasting. While I'm here, I'm spending the days here at the Institute and also hanging out at this residence, this very nice new residence, and which is on El Colegio in Isla Vista. Okay, and before I go on, I just want to thank my collaborators in Toronto, so Robert Faber, Stephanie Hay, and our students in my group, Thomas Oudar is a postdoc, and then lots of external collaborators. Russell is a graduate of our group and is working with James Screen at Exeter. Fred and Kelly were postdocs in my group as well, and Clara Dessering. John Fife, many of you will know. So as I said, I'm staying at this residence, okay? It's a nice, nice place. And it's a nice community of physicists, of the people in this program, and every Tuesday, we have a potluck dinner. And if you come in, you know, you come sort of turn off to the right, go to the back, there's this beautiful, nice dining hall, and there's a kitchen. And if you look in the kitchen, there's a magnificent contraption in there. I'll give you another look. It's this, it's this amazing stove, right? You know, this with this array of knobs and burners and all, you know, whatnot. Just a you know, complicated thing. And you spend a few minutes just trying to understand, you know, how do I turn this thing on? You know, and what. So many knobs, right? So you look and then, okay, there's a map, right? So I can look here and this one does that. All right, that's good. So you really have to study it to understand which knob is going to turn on which heating element. So maybe I can stop now. That's the point of my talk, is that we have to understand, there's not always an obvious way to find out how to heat up something by just looking at the device, all right? Okay, so let me talk about another contraption. This is a model, so it's a virtual contraption. Dargan Fearson and Tapio Schneider have developed a simplified atmospheric general circulation model that contains weather, okay? It's the fluid, primitive equations of motion solved in the sphere. It also has the addition of moisture in there. So we have moist effects, but in a very limited way. There's no interaction between the moisture and radiation, although there is simple radiative transfer in the code. And this is a testbed that we can use for lots and lots of virtual experiments, all right? So I'm going to talk to you a bit more detail later in the talk, but I wanted to start with this kind of image just to get us started. So the idea of this is a set of simulations. Actually, these are short simulations over just a couple of weeks period. So we've integrated this model over and over and over again. Okay, so we have an ensemble of realizations of a transient experiment. It's an initial value problem in which we start from random initial conditions, but at time zero we switch on heating. Okay, and the heating is imposed on a zonally symmetric background state. So it's an aquaplanet simulation, and we impose a zonally symmetric heating anomaly at different latitudes and of different strengths. And this is taken from a paper by Robert Faber. He worked with Fred and me, and Robert was also mentioned yesterday, so it's nice to hear his name in different contexts. So he ran these simulations, and actually it takes a lot of simulations because there's so much weather variability in this model. We need to do 100 or more realizations to get this kind of picture. But what we find is that when we heat at 55 degrees latitude, 6 65 degrees latitude, 45 degrees latitude, we get a lofted signal. So we get a warming response. So we're imposing a temperature perturbation here, and wait a couple of weeks, and it warms the Arctic. Okay, now in this model, the Arctic and Antarctic are the same. It's a model that's run in a way that there's a hemispheric symmetry, and so we just average together the north and south poles. But imagine this is the Arctic in a very idealized sense. And the point is that we can induce Arctic warming by imposing heating in the mid-latitudes, all right, in this very idealized setup. So it's kind of a slow-cooking experiment. You know, you have to figure out where the knobs are and then turn them on and see what heats up, all right? So in this strained analogy, I'm going to, you know, come back to our stove. Which burners heat the Arctic atmosphere? So I want you to keep that picture in mind. We'll come back to it later. But I want to make some key points today about more comprehensive and, I hope to say, realistic simulations of climate, okay? The first point is an observational point, which I'll deal with pretty quickly, and that is that there's a phenomenon of Arctic amplification, enhanced warming relative to the signal of global warming in the Arctic, and it extends from the surface, from the Earth's surface, where the boundary layer is, into the troposphere. And tropospheric Arctic amplification is something that we can reproduce readily in current generation climate models, all right? So it's not hard to find it, but it's hard to understand. That's my contention here. There's lots of burners, okay? So the burners involve sea ice loss, so high latitude change, but also there's a role for tropical warming and for mid-latitude warming. And I will tell you that this question is not something I will conclusively answer today, but I wanted to open up this set of questions and hopefully make points of contact with this workshop's focus and this program's focus on the boundary layer. Okay. So I wanted to first start about talking about observations. So the idea that there might be Arctic amplification in the polar troposphere has been around for a while, but I think the time I remembered it coming into the field was 2008, and it was a publication of this paper by Graverson and others looking at reanalyses. So the reanalysis products are mergers of atmospheric observations with models, so it's in a data simulation framework. And this paper came out in 2008 and claimed that actually not only was there warming in the Arctic mid-troposphere, but it was actually stronger than at the surface. And this was hugely controversial. And immediately on its publication in Nature, there were three comments, okay? There was Arctic warming aloft is data set dependent by Bits and Foo. Arctic tropospheric warming amplification ? The answer was probably not. Recent Arctic warming vertical structure contested, all right? So there was lots of controversy about this point. And it took a few years to settle out, but I would say that there's now more agreement about what's going on. And basically what seems to be going on is that if you take a trend over 20, 30 years of available data, you see a pretty robust structure. Certainly Arctic warming, so this is plotting temperature trends as a function of latitude with the pole on the left. So you'll find that all the UK papers have the North Pole on the left, and all the American papers have the North Pole on the other left, okay? So, pardon me? There's a right answer, and the answer is? That's left, of course. Yeah. So what you'll see this. So you'll have to bear with me. I'm going to be showing you lots and lots of versions of this kind of plot. Zonal mean temperature responses or trends as a function of latitude. So in fact, you know, there's basically only one figure in my talk to leading order. And the real question is, you know, if we take this as an observational fact that in winter, you know, we have strong warming at the surface, it extends up into the mid troposphere here, 500 millibars, hectopascals, and it's warmer here than at lower latitudes. So that's what I'm calling tropospheric Arctic amplification. So it takes me back. 2008 was actually the year of our first climate program here at KITP. So, you know, I'm a bit of a scatterbrain sometimes. So I was looking back in the archives, and so this is actually my family, my boys here. We brought here to KITP, and it's actually a lot of memories associated with this place, not just of picking up food as Ian was mentioning, but we had some very nice family time. So I'm going to bring them along for the talk, these guys. They look a little different now. So I'm going to ask, they're going to ask a few questions, and we'll see how I do in answering them. So, you know, the first question that you might ask, basic naive questions, and I've gotten this question before, is, well, what's so important about tropospheric Arctic amplification? Right? We live in the surface, you know, is it really an important phenomenon? And I would argue that tropospheric Arctic amplification is important. First of all, as somebody interested in the atmospheric circulation, and I hope you are too, we really want to understand how climate change and climate variability impact the stratification of the Arctic. This has a bearing on the clouds and composition of the Arctic, so there's all sorts of reasons just for basic understanding. But also, there's an important climate feedback associated with the vertical structure of temperature trends or temperature change, the lapse rate feedback, okay? And in this lapse rate feedback, which I won't dwell on, actually switches sign as you go from the tropics into the extratropics and into high latitudes. The lapse rate feedback acts to damp the rest of the global warming process in the tropics, where you have amplification of the temperature signal with height. But in the Arctic, you have this kind of decrease with height. And so although there is tropospheric amplification, it's the relative strength of this amplification relative to the surface is really important. So there is an important constraint on climate. And some of the role of the lapse rate feedback and other feedbacks in polar regions is reviewed in this team-authored paper. I was happy to be part of this. And this shows how the lapse rate feedback is actually the dominant feedback through radiative curvilinear calculations when you compare Arctic warming to tropical warming. So here, the lapse rate feedback acts negatively to damp temperature changes in the tropics, but to amplify them in the Arctic, okay? So this is actually, this lapse rate feedback could be one part of what you need to attribute to explain polar amplification itself. And it also helps explain aspects of the contrast between Antarctic warming and Arctic warming. So these other feedbacks and labels, there's a bit too much to cover here, but it is reviewed in this paper if you'd care to take a look. Okay, we have that, you know, basic idea that it might be important to study this phenomenon of tropospheric Arctic amplification. Okay, so the next naive question is, what causes it? All right, and this is the heart of the talk, and it's going to take a while to walk through what we know and what we understand. So I'm going to start by giving you a set of model results, and all these modeling results that I'll show in the next several slides are comprehensive atmospheric general circulation models or coupled circulation models. And within this section, there are a few key messages. The first is that if we turn on every burner we know about, okay, Arctic sea ice, all the temperature changes, if we give the atmosphere all the information at the surface that we know and observe, we can capture, approximately capture, observed tropospheric Arctic amplification. So I'll show you evidence for that. If we dig into this, we'll find that coupling to the ocean, the somewhat silly debate we were having about the ocean earlier, this is a critical part. So the oceanic adjustment is a critical part of this picture. We can't really understand the process of tropospheric Arctic amplification solely by looking at on the atmosphere. And the other thing I'm going to say, not too much about here, but I'm still interested in this topic, is that there's a very robust response to sea ice loss, and it turns out to be less robust than the remaining part of the response to greenhouse warming. And I unfortunately had to drop a lot of material related to that just in the interest of time. Okay, so first of all, I just want to make sure we're on the same page about this protocol we use in atmospheric general circulation models called AMIP, where what we do is we impose observed boundary conditions from sea surface, from the ocean surface, and from sea ice, and we use that as a forcing. And when we actually take, this is just an example of what you can do, you can take the sea surface temperature field with its trends and impose that as a forcing in the model together with the sea ice concentration field and its trends. These are the 30-year trends starting in 1980. You can do this kind of thing. It's very routine. It has an intercomparison named after it, AMIP, the first intercomparison. And the point about this is that if we prescribe all this boundary information as faulty as atmospheric simulations are, even at coarse resolution, we can reproduce trends over land surface and of atmospheric circulation and even interannual variability with quite a lot of fidelity. All right. So this is to say that the ocean and sea ice, and especially the ocean surface, encodes internal variability, but also it encodes all the forced changes from radiative forcing. And if we impose that forcing back on the atmosphere, even if we don't change the atmospheric composition, we can reproduce a lot of observed variability. So I'm going to show you an example of that in a couple of slides. But one of the first things I want to talk about is the impact of sea ice, because that's a key theme. So you can see here that we can impose trends in sea ice, and we can actually also remove sea ice entirely. And that these forced sea ice experiments have a lot of literature devoted to them now. And there's two types of experiments you can do. You can take a have I already been speaking for 20 minutes? Okay. You can take a model and remove sea ice and not let the ocean adjust to that. Okay. Or you can take a coupled model and induce a change in sea ice in various ways, either through nudging or changing sea ice properties. But basically, when you look at the impact of that sea ice removal, you get a robust set of effects. So this is an artificial thing to do, but it's very instructive. All right, so you can take a model and notice there's a negative sign here. You can impose a loss of sea ice, and here's various protocols from a paper by Clara and others, and impose a seasonal cycle, which basically mimics either observed sea ice loss or projected sea ice loss in the future. And you can impose or have calculate interactively a seasonal cycle of temperature change. And what you can measure as a result of that is a response in heat flux. Okay, so the blue and green line here represent two different types of ways of removing sea ice, but the answer is similar. All right, and the idea is that under climate change, you know, you have warmer SSTs over the Arctic, you have less sea ice. Notice the negative change here, a little bit of a lag in the sea ice response as the ocean warms up, all right? And then after you've removed the sea ice and the peak of the winter heat fluxes, that's when you get the strongest heat flux response. So the sensible turbulent and latent heat fluxes from the ocean peak. And so removing the sea ice in its entirety, or on average, let's say, leads to about a 50 watt per meter squared flux of heat. So that's a pretty strong buoyancy source sitting right at the surface. So this is maybe the most important slide in the talk, and it's not from my work, it's from a very nice paper by Screen and others in 2012, all right? Now this is not a latitude height cross-section, this is actually a representation of the seasonal cycle as a function of altitude, all right? And here are the observations. So I claim that the observations are settled enough, and this paper covered that point a little bit. Every dot here indicates statistical significance of a trend, and this is the average over several reanalysis data sets. And this, I would say, represents the consensus of the temperature trends that have happened as a function of height for January, February, March, April, and so on, all the way up to November, December. And you can see that in wintertime, there's a signal that goes up to, say, 500 hectopascals, all right? And this is the result of an AMIP simulation in which sea ice loss, the sea ice trends and the SST trends are imposed together. And you can see that there are differences, but the basic effect is captured there. So that was underlying my claim that basically models seem to get this. All right, there's a signal that looks, you know, it doesn't match up in all things, but it's basically able to get this. And this is without any additional forcing from any radiative forcing. This is only imposing SSTs and sea ice change. And the paper covers the other case with additional radiative forcing, which makes a little bit of a difference. Now this is the impact of imposing the changes in sea ice over the Arctic alone, and you can see. And there's also SST changes that are imposed when sea ice is lost, and so they do some minor adjustments for that. It's not very important. But the point of this, of course, is that the response to sea ice loss in isolation is really trapped in the planetary boundary layer. And then the difference between these two simulations, so GLB, global minus ARC, is called REM, which is remote, all right? And this is the remote effects. And the key point here is that the remote effects really amplify. So the impact from the rest of the world's oceanic adjustment is felt in the mid-troposphere. Okay, so sea ice loss has less influence than warming at lower latitudes. Okay, so you know, why might that be? So just to kind of get our heads around this a little bit, the main point is that the Arctic is strongly stably stratified, driven by radiative cooling in the polar night, especially in winter when we have the peak response in heat fluxes. And that stratification, that cap, is really going to cap the buoyancy source that you have at the surface. So you have 50 watts per meter squared, but you have this basic stratification, 30 degrees jump in potential temperature between the surface and 600 hectopascals. So absent other adjustments, sea ice loss will not do much by itself. And so that's kind of the basic fact here. You can see this in turbulent heat fluxes as well. So that's kind of where things stand as far as the AMIP models go. Okay, now there's more you can do. And so Clara Desser, a few years later, carried out experiments in which the sea ice loss was induced interactively in a coupled ocean atmosphere model. Now the contouring here is not strictly linear. So this was contoured to highlight a global impact. So unlike some of the previous slides, this is going from 90 south to 90 north. And one of the points of this paper is that when you induce sea ice loss in isolation, in a coupled ocean atmosphere model and allow the ocean to fully adjust, you see not only strong warming in the tropics, a little bit in the stratosphere, but also in the tropical upper troposphere and even into the southern hemisphere. So that local impact of sea ice loss extends all the way into the tropics and the other pole. Now, you can see that it's actually a fairly weak warming. This is projected warming at the turn of the century, projected ice loss at the end of the 21st century. And you see there's about 0.4 to 0.5 degrees of warming using kind of the reference of standard projected warming responses. It's not very strong. And so Clara calls this a mini global warming. Right? This mini global warming, it's in contrast to what happens if you impose the same sea ice loss, but back into one of these AMIP runs, into this prescribed SST run. And you can see then that the response is more surface trapped. And there's, of course, no response here because the ocean isn't allowed to adjust. Right? You don't have any tropical adjustment. And furthermore, and the key point I want to make for you here is that the tropospheric adjustment is very different. All right? So you have about a 50% more tropospheric warming in the presence of ocean coupling in the Arctic, even though when you impose it sea ice loss, there's a pretty weak warming. So what's causing that? And how can we reconcile this with the picture from the screen papers that suggested that sea ice by itself really wouldn't do it? Well, sea ice is doing all the work here in a sense. It's triggering things, but the ocean is playing a big role. But before I get into that, I just want to make a couple of other points, and that is that this has been repeated a few times, including work from coming from my group. And one of the nice things, James put several of these simulations together in a recent paper. So these are all coupled ocean atmosphere models, inconsistent models, forced in different ways. So every one of these boxes represents a different simulation, different protocol. And what we're seeing when we rescale by the amount of sea ice loss in millions of square kilometers is that we're getting basically the same atmospheric temperature response, more or less, per unit million square kilometers. And here we have CCSM4. Each of them has the French model, Canadian model, a couple of versions of the ANCAR model, and HADGEM. And for the most part, these simulations include also some sort of tropical response as well. They all have a mini global warming, with the exception of this model, which had actually a genuinely different way of forcing the ocean. So in this case, the ocean is actually nudged constrained. The deep ocean is constrained, and that's kind of a hint of, when I say deep, I mean below 200 meters. That's a kind of a hint as to the kind of dynamical response going on. Okay. Now, so this is what's happening when you impose sea ice loss, and we can ask about the relationship between this and the rest of the global warming process. So I appreciate there are a ton of panels here, and that there's a lot of information. But what we're trying to really do with these sea ice loss experiments is explain what's happening in this with the sea ice loss process in the context of the rest of global warming. And so I pulled these panels together. They're not consistent. But one of the main points I want to make is that when you remove the effect of sea ice loss from this effect here, you get a tropospheric response in the Arctic that it's not very consistent from model to model. All right. So the part that's related to sea ice loss is robust, but the part that's related to the rest of the global warming process, which is related to tropical warming, and transmission of that signal, it actually looks, it's not as robust across the different models. So that's something that we're still trying to sort through. And one of the ways we've tried to sort through this is by doing a bit of a statistical analysis or a reconstruction analysis. And what we realized is that if you look in a space that consists of Arctic sea ice area on one axis and lower latitude or tropical temperatures on another axis, the typical greenhouse warming experiment that we run when we're projecting global warming forward is to have a lot of sea ice loss accompanied by a lot of warming at low latitudes. And in these, oh boy, I'm really, it's already 5 minutes to go, only 5 minutes to go. So in these experiments, what we're able to do is induce a lot of sea ice loss, but we always get a bit of global warming. So I will skip the point, one of the points, so I can talk a little bit more about the dynamical side. But when we actually use the information from these two sets of simulations and recombine them, we can get we can actually do quite a lot to disentangle the signals that I was showing you in the previous slide. Okay, so given given the time constraints, I will talk about one more experiment that that highlights the role of the ocean in this, and then I will spend a couple of minutes talking about the dynamical aspects. All right, so one of the simulations we've done, it involves taking sea ice and reducing its albedo in order to darken it and induce sea ice loss in that way. Russell Blackport did this work for his thesis and induced changes to sea ice thickness and concentration and thickness, and also this this warming of the mid to high latitude ocean. And one question we were interested in is whether this adjustment of the ocean to the sea ice actually had an impact on the atmosphere. And so what we did was we took that same ocean ocean field and took it as a perturbation to add to a background control climatology, and used that to force CAM5, which is an atmospheric GCM. And when we impose sea ice loss, we get the familiar surface trapped signal. But when we add that ocean adjustment, you can see that the signal deepens. And so we think part of the basic dynamics we're dealing with here is an oceanic response, and this is the difference. There's a finer contour interval. But the basic idea is that this ocean adjustment at lower latitudes to sea ice forcing is what is part of what's causing that additional Arctic tropospheric warming. Okay, so that's, you know, that's the modeling world. I would say that the main point is that, you know, I still haven't answered the question that my critical audience had. You know, why does the Arctic troposphere warm? And there are a lot of hypotheses about this, okay? Because I've been focusing on the model world, I don't have time to go into the theoretical discussions that are going on. But there's a lot of candidates for direct forcing of the Arctic from the tropics, okay? So for example, we have Qingding here who's carried out simulations imposing warming patterns in the tropics, and which leads to at least regional responses in the Arctic, in particular over Greenland. And a lot of the work from the DESSER group suggested that it's the tropical adjustments that are really important in this process of driving like the high latitude signal. But there are other candidates as well. In fact, there's so much literature here. I gave a similar talk about a month ago, and I realized that there's not more than I could review. But the basic point is that a lot of the literature focuses on the role of moist advection, latent heat release, and/or the impacts of poleward advected moisture on the surface energy budget through long-wave radiation. And the work we've done in the group has really focused on this latter mechanism of latent heat release through poleward and upward moisture transport. So this gets back to the isentropic picture, all right? And I will make I'll show you one or two more slides before calling it off. But I just want to make a very simple point that if you look at this as a, you know, distribution of entropy or distribution of density surfaces or isopycnal surfaces, if you want, that if you consider this connection between the mid-latitude surface and the Arctic as one that can be accessed through adiabatic motions, and a dry picture would suggest that the Arctic atmosphere is linked to 40 degrees north or so. But a moist picture, which accounts for latent heat release, will bring those isentropes closer. So if you have quasi-adiabatic motions that bring poleward warm and moist anomalies, you'll actually have a better chance of ventilating the Arctic and understanding that process in a bit more detail. So to show you an illustration of that, this is an observational study that Fred Laliberté did, looking at what is empirically how Arctic temperatures in summertime are correlated with surface temperatures a month earlier. And this is actually the correlation of mid-tropospheric temperatures in the Arctic with surface temperatures, but it's all surface equivalent potential temperatures. And you can see that there's a pattern of warming that's associated a month earlier with the warmer temperatures in the Arctic, and it's focused over land areas. And he used that this empirical relationship and actually applied that to the long-term variability in the Arctic mid-troposphere and found a pretty good model for how the Arctic troposphere is both varying from year to year, but also it's the long-term trends. And this reconstruction is to take the surface temperature and calculate theta E anomalies from that, and then map that and just use that simple mapping regression coefficient of almost one, okay? So basically a one-to-one map between the average temperature in the mid-latitude surface and the polar temperatures. I've shown you a little bit from Robert's work, but just to give you his the broader picture of what he did. So again, he imposed these anomalies at different latitudes, at different strengths, and in all these simulations, it's not exactly the same, it's not a perfect match, you need to do a lot of averaging. But what it seems to be is that the response and equivalent potential temperature is really organized by the climatological mean potential temperature. So it's a simple way of mapping in this transient problem what's going on at the surface to what's going on in the Arctic free troposphere. And the very last picture I'll show you is this one from another study of Fred's, and that is to look at the long-term climate responses. And now the seasons keep shifting here, so this is actually looking at September, October, November. This is the response in equivalent temperature to projected warming in the 21st century, in potential temperature, dry, and in moist potential temperature. And you can see that in the Arctic, what looks like strong polar amplification in the troposphere is really connected to the surface, and that again, the control climatology, the unforced climatology's distribution of potential temperature serves to organize or connect the response in the Arctic. So this is kind of the way a way forward to think about this problem. The dynamical aspects I can't really cover in detail. Okay, so just to recap. So it's kind of a rapid tour, lots of results. So I think I've made these points that we can capture Arctic amplification in current climate simulations. There's lots of candidate mechanisms, and because of that, we don't know if we're capturing that response for the right reasons. All we know is that it is there, and there's various ways to generate it. And all these processes, everything is oriented towards the surface. So of course, boundary layer dynamics, which I haven't covered, is key to really getting this right. And I think I've mentioned these two points. And so I think with that, I'll just move into the end. So, right, thanks for you. And they're a little bit more grown up now.
Yeah. Are there any questions?
I really enjoyed your talk. I have one quick question. Can you go back to that slide that you said was the main one, if we notice any?
Right.
Yeah. So there were a lot of simulations you showed here, including this one that have just changing the Arctic surface forcing and not putting in the full global signal. I didn't catch if there were simulations where you did the opposite, but I'm just trying to get my head around this issue of using the residual between B and C to get at the remote effects. That it doesn't seem like these things would necessarily linearly add, even if the whole system is sort of governed by linear dynamics.
Yeah.
It's easy to come up with situations where these wouldn't add, and how you call remote effects the part, the residual between the two, where you could have done the flip side and maybe gotten a very different answer if you had just done greenhouse forcing and specified the sea ice to stay constant.
Yeah, just to be clear, it's not greenhouse forcing, it's just imposing the SST changes. But anyway, yes, we've seen lots of evidence in our the AMIP simulations we did with, I showed you that result from Russell's thesis that's still in review, and one of the issues we ran into is that when we try to reconstruct SSTs with sea ice and so on, it's really hard to get, especially a circulation response that's very robust. And what I showed, and additivity doesn't seem to work perfectly. On the other hand, I don't think that what I think we're seeing here would be pretty robust. I mean, this result has been found. There's a paper by Perlwitz and others which shows basically the same thing. That the main point being that much of the tropospheric warming we see is not directly attributable to sea ice loss. Unfortunately, those papers kind of neglect the ocean, right? They really do neglect the ocean in the sense that they attribute the change to the ocean, but they don't talk about how the ocean gets warm. And what I think we're learning now is that the sea ice is leading, the sea ice is part of the positive feedback that helps warm the ocean. It might be through the tropics. In fact, it probably is. But there are impacts of sea ice. Sea ice is a driver, but it's kind of separate. It's a separate mechanism. About the point about nonlinearity, I mean, in this study, this was I can't speak to what they did, but I think there's lots of scope for trying to identify linearities. James does have another study focused on regional sea ice perturbations, and there he has a kind of a very clear nonlinearity in the regional responses. Yeah,
taking
him.
The same figure.
Say about the spring warming in the observations, absent in the rest.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember if other studies have if this is actually, I think, the ensemble mean of two simulations. There might be both the UK and CAM3, so an older version of CAM. So I'm not sure if other studies have been done that reproduce that. So no, I don't have anything useful to say about it. Except to say that the shoulder seasons are when we see the most nonlinearity. So spring and fall are when we see the most nonlinearity in the dynamical responses. And I don't know what that means about the tropospheric responses, say outside the planetary boundary layer. So I have little to say, but I think it's an excellent question.
Okay. And a related question would be to go back to one of your four seasonal panels of the observed amplification.
Yeah.
And talk about why they're so different.
Oops. Yeah. Ah. No, did I pass it?
I think it was earlier.
Oh, yeah, it was right at the beginning, right? Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I think you can somewhat walk through this. First of all, this is a 20-year trend, all right? So impacts of internal variability are going to be very strong in this picture. So I haven't seen an update of this either starting 1980 going to 2010 for the reanalysis. So I think that's one thing you have to realize. So there's lots of internal variability. I feel like we have a better handle on winter in terms of what to expect. But again, the shoulder seasons. So here, this is really strong. I mean, the point of this paper is the central role of diminishing sea ice extent in recent Arctic temperature amplification. And really, this can be attributed to sea ice loss through the coupled mechanism that I identified. Summer, and Ching has worked on this, summer is an interesting period because the direct effects of sea ice loss won't be felt as strongly, and yet there's lots of ocean warming to think about there. So I think each season might be its own planet in a way. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but as you go into wintertime, we know why the surface heating is so strongly trapped. There's a very strong inversion, and here this is peak sea ice loss period. These kind of funny shapes, I wouldn't pretend. There might be dynamical responses, or these might be real or not, we don't know, but if they were, there might be stratospheric impacts that we'd have to figure in as well. So there's lots of scope for different types of investigation. Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering about, you know, sort of giving the thermodynamic part of the dynamic perspective in this talk, but it's sort of the dynamical effect and the alternate side is sort of the effect of waves.
Yeah.
And if you could comment on your gut feeling of sort of the relative importance of the two in these effects.
So the point I didn't really get to make, thanks for the question, is that our picture of you know, what's controlling all of the extratropics is really wave-driven circulations from baroclinic eddies, all right? And there's different ways of portraying this. This is, but if you calculate, so you can calculate overturning stream functions, so mass stream functions in different coordinate systems with more or less Lagrangian information in them, all right? You can do this in dry coordinates, dry potential temperature, moist potential temperature coordinates. And if you calculate the eddy-driven contribution to those, it's dominated. It's the dominant contribution. So there's only some eddy. Is that what you're asking about? Or
I'm asking about the stationary waves.
Oh, the stationary waves, the planetary waves. So in the
why don't you finish that answer?
Okay.
Just
right. Yeah. So the waves. So in the winter time. So you can obtain circulation cells like this in an aquaplanet model, all right? Now, so there's the real world and then there's the model world. So you can obtain, circulation cells basically of this strength, of observations in, 11 sverdrups or something like that, you know, order 10 sverdrups of mass overturning just from the impact of transient synoptic scale eddies alone. Then when you add stationary waves, that will modulate the picture, and I honestly don't know if I know there's literature, but I can't remember what fraction these contribute in each season. But there's certainly a role for understanding the regional, on a regional scale, what's going on by considering transport of moisture by stationary waves. But the big picture in the simulations that I showed here, very briefly, right? It's just that transient eddies are doing all the work. This is a model with no background zonal asymmetry. But these pictures might very well change, and the question then is, how does a stationary wave, how do the stationary waves determine the background stratification to start with? And then when you go further and perturb that system, how would you describe the impact on poleward heat transport? So one of the main, I didn't have time to talk about this, but this literature that I skimmed over, and I'm sure there's much more that I could have said, set of papers here, so Soo-Kyung Lee has a set of papers focused on the stationary wave driving of poleward moisture transports. It's something called the team hypothesis, all right? And the point of view from her group is that stationary planetary waves systematically transport moisture and moist entropy out of the tropics into the high latitudes, and that's a leading order contribution to the energetics of the Arctic. All right, and what's significant about that is that you can actually—it's a pretty efficient mechanism for transporting heat, even if you have relatively little control from kind of large-scale baroclinicity. It's a way of inducing Arctic amplification just by bodily moving large amounts of moisture poleward. And then the other part of that mechanism involves a radiative impact, that you just push that moisture poleward as a kind of passive tracer, and then it's shining long wave down on the surface and actually impacting the surface heat budget. And that's the level of uncertainty we have right now, is whether you need radiation to explain the direct radiative impact of long wave. Of water vapor to explain what we see in terms of Arctic amplification. So there's lots of workshops, but we had a workshop, a discussion of polar amplification on this in the last summer in Aspen, and these ideas were discussed, but no conclusion was was arrived at.
So we have time for one more question.
Yeah.
Back here, and then next speaker can start setting up.
Just a quick question. Yeah. So I just wonder, do you have any insights about recent 5 years change in Arctic? It seems like after 2012, there's no any other year break the record in September sea ice minimum. So just do you think the AA phenomenon disappear, or recent 5 years change is due to something else, or so do you have any idea about this the same to the pulse of the Arctic warming recently?
Nothing I can really, say confidently. The only thing I would say is that 5 years is a very short time in the Arctic. And I was thinking of starting this whole talk about talking about how noisy the Arctic is and how hard it is to pick out signals. If you look year by year, you can get really distracted. And so all the modeling results I showed you were either multi-century integrations or hundreds of realizations. Because I think that's the kind of sampling you need to detect, even to understand projected climate change in the Arctic, you really need a long, long history. In your work, where you're bringing the atmosphere back, to the observed record, that has its own role, because if you're nudging to the real world, then you can actually test mechanistically what's going on. But in terms of any 5 year period, so I'm not sure. So I can't say what's happened in the last five years. But it is a good point. We haven't had a record. We don't have a lot of sea ice though, and we don't have a lot of old ice anymore, right? The Arctic is a very different place now than it used to be, and a lot of that is just that you have seasonal reformation of the sea ice, but it's not. It's a different place. It really is. So even though the ice volume is just a very, very strongly permanent trend, I think, that we're dealing with. Yeah. And that hasn't really changed in the last 5 years. I think I should stop.
Let's thank Paul again.